powered by Clint, the clinical intelligence platform. You're listening to Beyond the Chart with Stanford cardiologist, Dr. Raj Dash. Today, Raj is joined by Brendan Mullen, the Senior Executive Vice President of the American College of Cardiology.
Welcome. I am Raj Dash. I am a cardiologist at Stanford University, but I'm also co-founder of Clint, the clinical intelligence platform. And the Beyond the Chart podcast is really an effort to really bring together the stakeholders, the key stakeholders in healthcare today, to talk about some of the challenges and some of the solutions, particularly as it may pertain to digital health, but also education, and how we can solve some of the fundamental challenges in healthcare today. Our guest today is Brendan Mullen. He is the Senior Executive Vice President of the American College of Cardiology. And I'm incredibly excited to have him on because I've known Brendan for a number of years now, and I'm constantly riveted by his views on how healthcare is evolving and where it needs to go. And he's in this amazing position within the ACC to influence that. And I'm super excited to bring his insights and presence to our community today. Brendan, welcome.
Thanks, Raj.
Just a quick background that I will give, and then I'll ask you to give a little bit more about your role at the ACC. But in his role, he's really involved with all things, marketing, communications, business development, digital and enterprise strategy, and even international affairs, but also really heavily involved with the science and the quality initiatives within the college. And he's, my understanding, you've been there since 2008 and have really risen to the top of this organization and overseen many things in healthcare changing during that time period. And so it's really fascinating the perspective that you may have around what's happened with our healthcare system. And so what I'd like to do is give you a chance to tell us a little bit more about your role at the ACC and some of the motivation behind the work that you're doing today. So.
Great. Thanks, Raj. Thanks for having me on. It's really fun. I actually started in healthcare right out of school, worked in healthcare consulting for the better part of 10 years before I went over to the American College of Cardiology. And that transition was about trying to be closer to how care was delivered and understanding, you know, the crucial element that the physician still provides in this entire ecosystem. I think it's, you know, it's the crucial element of healthcare is the physician. And over the course of that 16 or 17 years there, a lot of my career has followed a lot of the trends that have been top of mind in healthcare writ large. And that's not because of my doing, sort of by accident, but it's been interesting to kind of ride on those various waves. Probably the ones that are most relevant is the rise of clinical big data, kind of in the early to mid-2000s, that first decade. And as you think about how that coalesced with the concept of value-based care and healthcare reform under the Affordable Care Act in President Obama's first term, I think we have had a real change in the way we discuss the industry. And my role at the college at that point was developing our ambulatory cardiovascular data registry, which was in the suite of our larger registries. And from that, then ended up working in a variety of the areas of science and quality in the National Cardiovascular Data Registries, in big data, increasingly into machine learning and artificial intelligence and the type of vanguard technologies that we're involved in. I think one of the things that's remarkable about being at the American College of Cardiology is that it is obviously the organization that represents about 95% of practicing cardiologists in the United States. It represents 52,000 members around the world, not just physicians, but also care team members and administrators and technicians and sort of aligned professions, but really centered around that moment where the physician, the care team are trying to make decisions about what's the best thing to do for the patients in front of them. And almost all of our work, whether that's in membership, whether that's in our journals, whether that's in our education program, whether that's in our registries, is focused on trying to understand that moment, if you think about it, the moment where you, Raj, and your colleagues are sitting across from someone who's probably vulnerable and a little bit scared, And you're equipped with this massive amount of scientific knowledge that has been generated in the last 100-150 years, and trying to make the right decision with very scarce resources and very scarce time. So it's just my incredible privilege to work at the ACC with the incredible team there and to try to take on the challenges that are vexing all of us in healthcare and particularly cardiologists.
That's fascinating journey as well. And I think, you know, as you mentioned, when you were starting at the ACC, I was starting my career at Stanford. And I think that around that time with the healthcare changes that happened with the Obama administration, there was a lot of excitement and promise to the electronic health record adoption across the industry. And this opportunity that the American College of Cardiology took to build a registry, to create what is now the largest cardiovascular outpatient registry that exists, to study the quality of care that was being delivered and to discover practice habits and behaviors that maybe weren't quite up to par, but how then to turn that into quality improvement was really a tremendous vision that has been sort of realized now. Can you talk a little bit about not just the real world evidence, but how they are using real world evidence within the college and then the committees that are building our medical guidelines? Like how do you view the role of real world data now in the development of new evidence and guidelines for practicing clinicians, as opposed to just the randomized clinical trial data that's really been the sort of tried and true foundation of those guidelines?
Yeah, it's I was in preparation of this podcast, I was thinking back over a little bit of that history, and you know, my daughters are now in middle school and in high school, and so you know, pretty much every week I'm studying with a test for them for some era, and I started thinking in the context of, you know, how are people going to look back 100 years from now on this period starting in 2008, 2009, 2010 with the you know, the Recovery Act and then the Affordable Care Act that sort of jump started the digitization of American medicine. And I suspect they'll look back 100 years from now and see this two-decade period as being this one of rapid and incredible transformation, where we went from all of this medical knowledge either locked in individuals' people's brains or committed to paper, as it had been for all of history, to a world where information is dynamic and it's individualized and it's rapid and we're analyzing with all these technologies. Now, of course, living through those two decades has been, the pun is intentional here, an epic disaster for trying to figure out how this information works, dealing with the needs of privacy, dealing with interoperability, dealing with the you know, the commercial constraints and sometimes commercial avarice of the parties involved. So it's been really difficult, and I think most of us probably have a sense of I would call it now cynical optimism, right? We see that over the course of a generation, this is going to pay huge dividends. But it's been a lot harder and a lot more painful, I think, than most of us expected. I sort of break it down into kind of three categories to answer your question more directly. So the randomized controlled trial clearly still creates the evidentiary base that is the primary resource which we're using to understand you know, the pathology of disease and how we should intervene on it to get the best outcomes. And those randomized controlled trials are obviously the bedrock of what we believe in cardiology, which is one of the most empirical fields in medicine. But of course they have limitations, and those limitations, particularly in cardiology, as the, you know, the marginal risk reductions we get from each new medication, each new therapy, are relatively modest. You need to study more and more and more people for longer and longer periods of time. And that, of course, gets incredibly expensive, incredibly complicated. And at some point, I think we're starting to push against the boundaries of how much can you reasonably spend on a randomized controlled trial? How long can you reasonably keep patients engaged? And in some ways, and this is probably a bit controversial, you know, I think the growth derivative on the value of the RCT in many applications is probably starting to flatten out a little bit. And so that moves us into kind of the next adjacency, and that is, okay, what is this real world evidence that we have about how these this information, this kind of pure science, is getting applied in the field? And as you know, and I know most of our listeners know, what we see is real material gaps between what we think is best practice, what the evidence suggests we should be doing to get the best outcomes to patients, and what's actually happening. And we spent a lot of time in the Pinnacle Registry, at what point having, you know, literally thousands of cardiologists looking at every patient interaction. And even on the metrics that you think would be super well established, you know, every physician, every cardiologist knows that we should be anticoagulating for a you know, an atrial fibrillation patient that has a modest to high risk of ischemic stroke. Every patient knows about beta blockade after MI. Every patient knows about these basic, or every physician knows about these measures. And then we would see the performance. We see these real deltas between what was being achieved in the clinic and what was you know, prescribed in our guidelines. And for a long time, I think for the better part of the last 10 or 15 years, we've tended to attribute to that, oh, that's an education gap. It's an implementation gap. Somehow this knowledge that we're developing guidelines, physicians aren't able to apply. They don't know how to apply. In the last several years, I've started to change my thinking on that pretty dramatically. And think that those gaps that we see, that people tend to think of our failure to achieve guidelines, they don't represent failures of physicians. They represent a sort of failure of our philosophy for how we should be treating those patients. In some ways, that goes back to the evidence, where we run these randomized controlled trials on large but specific populations, and we kind of think of them as vertical tranches. You either have disease A or disease B or disease C or disease D, and we figure out exactly how you should treat that. Yet in the real world, of course, the patients you're seeing, Raj, every day have all four of those diseases, or two of the four, or three of the four. And the net result is it would be really difficult for any physician or any patient to be able to prescribe, to manage, to take all of the, even the class one indicated therapies. And so, you know, what we saw in Pinnacle 5-10 years ago in anticoagulation or beta blockade or, ACE and ARB for LVSD, is only getting multiplied now, for example, as we go to four pillars in heart failure. I think a Jack article just came out the other day that said in a major population, we're getting to about 6.7% of heart failure patients in a major population. We're getting the four pillars of GDMT. I mean, 6.7%.
That's terrible.
Why is that? I don't think it's because cardiologists don't know what those four pillars are. I think there's a variety of other constraints, systems, financial, cognitive, that are making it really difficult to do the right thing, even when we know the right thing. And so to me, that's where the promise of digital medicine and the kind of technologies that you're working on, we're working on the ACC, come in, because it leads us to the potentiality, which didn't exist 5-10 years ago, that we may be able to think about how you take this evidence that's been developed at scale and gets applied to the individual in front of us, so that we're getting, the Pascal's rule of benefit, the 80-20, you know, which medicines, which therapies, which interventions, do we use to get the best benefit? And as I often talk to my cardiology friends about this, I think this is, you know, when I admire physicians, what I admire is their ability to do this intuitively, instinctively every day. It's what you're trained for and what you do with your patients, and it's why we have such good outcomes in often very difficult circumstances. But that intuition, that knowledge, we have a hard time aggregating it, and we have a hard time testing whether that intuition is in fact right. Is it the right combinations of medicines that we're using? Is it the right combinations of therapies in the right order? And I think the promise of these digital technologies and real-world evidence at scale, and a lot of the new mathematical modeling that comes out, is that we can actually start to test that much more empirically and give our physicians a whole new set of toolkits over the next 5 or 10 years to feel like they're not just applying their intuition, but applying sort of a next generation of evidentiary science to caring for the patients.
And so that was amazing. And I think that you said a few things there that I think are provocative, because, you know, I think that the FDA is really interested in real world evidence and how it can be used to help with the approval and monitoring of safety of drugs. But in terms of the actual inclusion into the medical guidelines, in terms of the ability and the nimbleness of our guidelines and our medical societies that are yep. issuing those to move with the evidence, not just from the trial space, which takes a long time, as we know, to do those trials, but also from the real-world evidence that is being generated every moment of every day.
Yep.
You know, how are we going to incorporate those things into practice? We know that medical guidelines take forever to become adopted at steady state in the community, right? Everyone hears about this 17-year yep. number, and it needs to get better, right? It needs to improve and accelerate dramatically. And what you're speaking about, it sounds like, are technologies that will enhance the intuition of clinicians at the point of care, that will improve the workflows so that they know that they're not missing gaps in care, but also they are still able to operate as a physician in terms of knowing their patient and all of the nuance and compassion that's required to do that, but also not lose out on the opportunity to leverage the technologies of today to achieve excellence. I mean, I think that's what you're saying, and I don't know if I captured that correctly, but it's refreshing to hear. Is that kind of what you're trying
yeah,
to get at?
So I one of the things I think we need to be careful about with technology, clinical decision support, electronic medical records, even when they're working right, is that pointing out to a physician that you haven't done things when you're already bouncing up against these budget constraints doesn't actually help. So if the technology can't say, not, you know, doc, you're missing these three guideline-directed medicines, but if the technology can't tell you, you're missing these three, but this is the one that is going to have the most effect, and by the way, it's also the one that the patient can afford. If the technology can't tell that, the technology is just infuriating the physician and contributing to this burnout. You know, I also, one of the great things with ACC is I get to work with a lot of people, and one of the groups I work with is our ethics committee. We think about the ethics and philosophy of this stuff, and we talk about a lot of the burnout that physicians are feeling. You know, feels like it's originating from this place of almost from moral injury, where the physician who's made a commitment to really put the life of the patient often above their own in terms of their commitment, their emotional commitment, their physical commitment, and so forth, then can't do the things that they're being told to do. And that is really, really, emotionally, psychologically, I think, harmful to the field. And I think we see that across the board.
Yeah.
So if we're using our technology just to browbeat physicians and say, you're not doing the right, that we would be ludicrous to think that we're going to get a better outcome. So yeah. Part of me thinks, you know, we need to step back here. And you know, I was trained, as you know, Raj, I wasn't trained in medicine, not a physician. The closest my formal training to is in economics and maybe a little bit of philosophy thrown in. But an economist would look at this problem and say, okay, what you have is probably for each patient, you have three overlapping budget constraints, right? You have a cognitive budget constraint, and that's for the patient and the physician. How many mm-hmm. medicines, diseases can you as a physician keep track of for that patient and keep track of all of the interactions you need to? And when that patient goes home at 77 years old, how many medicines and routines and habits and directions can that individual keep track of on a day-to-day basis, right? So you have this cognitive constraint. You have a physiological constraint. So how many medicines or therapies or interventions can you actually put in someone's body before you start getting drug-drug interactions, side effects, blood pressure drops, just not feeling great, okay? And then you have financial constraints. So how many drugs can the average, if we're just sticking with polypharmacy here, we could be talking about other interventions too, but how many therapies can your average American afford to take and not start crowding out other things they care about? So from an economist's point of view, those are just budget constraints. And when an economist looks at these things, he's like, oh, that's an optimization problem. You know, you set up what you're trying to accomplish, which is the best well-being for that patient, conditioned on how much they can cognitively handle, how much they can physiologically handle, and how much they can financially handle. And I think, so when I step back and I look at these problems, I see a philosophical problem is that much of medicine still operates on this maximization philosophy. That is, we are going to do everything we can for an individual patient. And it sort of ignores that these constraints are there. And then we're kind of shocked when we find that only 65% of the patients are anticoagulated, that only 7% of the patients are on GDMT for heart failure. And again, it's not because the physician's not doing the right thing. It's not because the patient doesn't want to be better. It's because we're just ignoring other realities that are outside of our traditional thinking about medicine, but are absolutely the determinative realities for real human beings, you know, making real choices. So yeah. If you start moving away from the idea of maximization, then, but that idea that we need to think about optimizing for the best interest of the patient, that has to permeate through all of us, and we're not real good at it, right? Pharmaceutical companies don't want to do that because they might not want to find out that a combination of inexpensive generics is better than your brand new, yeah, you know, $12,000 a year blockbuster. The FDA doesn't like it because it requires us to make normative and value judgments. And we don't like making normative and value judgments, right, in science and medicine. You know, politicians don't like it because we might have to admit that we don't have the greatest healthcare system in the world, right? So getting to the point where we're actually doing the best we can for the patient, I think requires all of us to kind of step back and think differently. Now, if you bring that back to technology, then now you see how that technology, whether it's artificial intelligence or computational analytics or whatever it is, could be a force for real power here, or it could be a real problem. And again, it's a problem if we just keep beating up on physicians and nurses and providers for not doing a thing that we know is impossible to do. So I'm one of my favorite statistics I've ever heard at Heart House, and it's driven more thinking than probably any other I've ever read, is that adherence to medication drops off precipitously after 5 medications. So if we know that's a fact and we see it in study after study after study, why would we ever prescribe a GDMT regime that requires more than 5 medications? And then we're shocked when patients aren't taking it. So it's kind of like, and sometimes I feel like sometimes we're just ignoring the laws of physics and pretending that they don't apply to us, when those laws of physics, you know, that define all of our human behaviors, which are flawed and imperfect and we make trade-offs, is the reality that our patients are. And I think that's where, to me, the idea of beating up on cardiologists for not doing the right thing has sort of worn out for me when I hear that from payers or from pharmaceutical companies from the government, because I just think it ignores the realities that you are working with your colleagues every day with patients.
Well, no, I think that's completely true. I think when in terms of the workflow of a clinical practice, in terms of a physician or any clinician and their care team that's taking care of that patient and a whole roster of patients, the competing interests are really getting in the way of, as you said, like what they already know what the right thing to do is. If they were only seeing a patient who had diabetes, they would get it right pretty much every time, like 100 times out of 100, they'd probably get it right. But they're not dealing with just diabetes. They're dealing with, you know, 5 or 6 or 7 different chronic conditions, plus an acute complaint that day, and you know, the time constraints of their clinic, where they have just a few minutes with the patient, and all of these things to cover. It's just not going to get done. And I think that's really where I've been really passionate about kind of bringing technology to that space. I think what I've learned, and I think I'd love your feedback on this, because I think the ACC is also a leader in this way, is that if you're going to implement technologies that help improve visibility into what to do for patients at what time, according to evidence, these clinical decision support systems have really been pretty limited in their scope and their capabilities and their success. And I think maybe they've, as you said, browbeaten these clinicians, and instead of improving awareness and focusing on motivation, focusing on a little bit of competitive energy to see how they're doing against their colleagues, but But also, when you think about health systems implementing these things, they're not cheap, right? Mm-hmm. They're expensive technologies. And I want to have your comments on how the ACC has really brought together the stakeholders, right? The healthcare system and the patients are definitely and should be the focus of our efforts in terms of improving outcomes. But these kinds of technologies are unlikely to be adopted by health systems if they're footing the bill entirely yep. for it, right? You have to have a win for them and a win for whom else? Well, probably the companies that have developed these medications have got them yep. into the guidelines through that effort and now are seeing them not adopted at right. massive levels, as you saw. So how is the ACC working? And you've developed an ecosystem, basically, within the ACC. If you could speak to that a little bit in terms of the partnerships and the leadership that you guys are taking in terms of bringing those two stakeholders together.
Yeah, I think, you know, where it starts, if you go back to your comments about sort of classic clinical decision support, there's sort of a paradox there that we found. And that is, if you take given the structure of medical information in most electronic medical records, in order to get the decision support so accurate and deterministic in the algorithm that it is indeed right every time it fires, the net result is it's so reductionist in terms of its value contribution that it just annoys physicians, right? Because most of the physicians know already what's there and ends up getting turned off. On the other hand, if you want to get to this idea where there is more nuance and there's more equipping a physician to make good decisions, right? All of that is more complicated. The technology is more complicated. The evidence you need to use is more complicated, and it's more expensive. But we do think that there is a path forward here that feels constructive, and this is about getting the ecosystem together. And you know, Raj, as we've worked with you and your team, one of the things that I've always love since the first time I've seen some of the ways that you were thinking about these challenges is being able to visually represent information to physicians in a way that it's appealing, it's instantaneously apparent, and it's not reductionist or directive. It says, okay, you have a series of choices because there are a series of things that need to be done for these patients, and then you equip the physician working with the patient to have that discussion and to make those trade-offs. I think we would both like over time to have more evidence and more computational power, so that's getting more personalized. But you guys are already on that right. road to making that. And so if you have that avenue to getting to a solution that is evidence-based, that is reasonable for both the physician and patient, then we've actually kind of broken through some of the some of the ossification that's happened, and now there's new opportunity. So, one of the things where we're trying to bring folks together is we're trying to understand where, for example, there's interest in new therapeutics and new pharmacy applications. So new drugs. Which we respect. I mean, like, we're so grateful for those companies making those investments and bringing those products to market. We want them to work too. We want them to find the right patients through the right doctors. So what we've been trying to do is bring together where the life sciences companies have new technologies that are really going to benefit patients and have been proven through the traditional randomized controlled trial. To bring together our physicians that are looking to get better outcomes for patients, but realize that approaching this the same old way is not getting the type of progress we want. And then looking for technology partners who are capable of aggregating information and giving the type of next generation decision support that allows decisions to be made inside those budget constraints that I was talking about earlier. And by doing that, I think we're finding that we're making some progress. We are seeing patients getting access to the medications they need, physicians more capable and comfortable of using them. That being said, it's never quite as clean or as fast as anyone would like, because sometimes we're still struggle. What I would say is actually doing this work, it forces us to confront the truisms that we've always had, or at least has been dictating cardiology and medicine for a long time. So one of the things that I really struggle with when I'm in academic conferences or academic settings, if someone says, well, we really need a randomized controlled trial to tell us X, Y, Z. And if you know that the such randomized controlled trial will never be run and it will never be funded, then saying I need a randomized controlled trial to tell me X, Y, Z is kind of like saying I should go to the moon tomorrow. Again, it's sort of ignoring the reality. So what, we're working a lot with Harlan Krumholtz now as a new editor-in-chief and, of course, loves these topics and is really bringing this passion, this sort of stuff. He's a great phrase. You know, it's called possible adjacent. So, you know, if I know that I'm never going to be able to run a randomized controlled trial to do this, then let's look to the next possible adjacent. And that possible adjacent usually is in the real-world evidence with really, really advanced capabilities. That can tell us a lot about who these medicines are going to work for and how they're going to work. Are they perfect? No. Do they have bias? Yes. Should we be worried about the results and whether we have endogeneity problems in these data sets? Absolutely. But ironically, those are the exact same problems that people argue about at academic conferences about the RCTs too. So I think it's trying to get those together and then, you know, working with all the stakeholders to understand that, yeah, this makes us all a little bit uncomfortable, but doing the same thing is not going to change the status quo. So this makes our life sciences partners a little bit uncomfortable, right? Because, and it should, right? They're regulated by the FDA. They have very strict parameters about what they're allowed to say about their medicines, how they're allowed to talk about those medicines to physicians. We've finally gotten physicians, you remember, Raj, probably when we started with the guidelines and appropriate use criteria, we were getting told it was cookbook medicine, you're taking away. So now that we finally got everyone bought into guidelines to start saying, well, you know, it's actually kind of a combination of guidelines and, you know, it's going to require these things that aren't going to be randomized tested. Like that sounds pretty heretical. It makes a lot of physicians uncomfortable. It feels much safer to try to do the thing that is absolutely black and white. I completely understand it. FDA struggles with it. Payers struggle with it. Everybody struggles with it. But I think, you know, part of the thing that we're trying to do is to, by bringing together the stakeholders, so the life sciences companies, by interested physicians, by technologies, by health systems, even by insurers who really care about this, we're trying to find the path forward. And in finding the path forward, we're actually trying to illuminate the structural problems that are keeping us from making progress. So instead of saying things like, well, if we just had an RCT on XYZ, we say, all right, what would we need? What evidence would we need? What technology would we need in order to be confident enough that we are going to approach treating this patient a little bit differently, to recognize that, you know, they're not gonna be able to afford all these medications, they're never gonna take them. And that's kind of where we're trying to push out. And as I said, I go back to my history lessons, I think, you know, year after year, man, it seems slow and we get frustrated and kind of pull our hair out and say all sorts of words that would need to be bleeped on this podcast, but by the time my grandkids are studying this period of medicine, I think they'll look back and they'll say this period from 2010 to about probably 2030 or 2040 just absolutely transformed medicine.
So I agree with you, and I think we're going through this sort of renaissance in terms of bringing the stakeholders to the same table and identifying technologies that can create harmony within that interaction. One of the things you mentioned really caught my attention, which is, you know, not just to identify patients who might benefit from a certain treatment amongst a class of drugs, that this one is going to be more effective in this individual based off of our understanding of real world results, but also can they afford it? And it gets back to health equity.
Yeah.
And I think I wanted to definitely spend a little bit of our time near the end here on the efforts that the college has to improve health equity within clinical care, but also how you are looking to create equity within clinical research. And I know the college has a few programs to train investigators who are wanting to get into clinical research, are of a particular underrepresented minority, perhaps, themselves, and may be able to bring those patients into trials who are really grossly underrepresented. Could you speak a little bit to that and other health equity initiatives that you wanted to highlight maybe for the college?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought us back to that, Raj, for a couple of reasons. One is I'm really excited and proud of the work that the college is doing, and it's great to talk about it. But I also think it brings us back to reality that, you know, we can be clever as we want with the patients in front of us. If huge percentages of patients who need access to cardiovascular care aren't ever even getting into the system or getting access, it doesn't matter how clever we are or how good we are with the patient in front of us, particularly if we're worried about long-term trends in morbidity and mortality, right? We're not going to reverse the uptick in morbidity and mortality and cardiovascular disease by decreasing, you know, acute kidney injury during PCI or bleeds at this point. Like, those are important metrics. We need to keep making improvement. That's not going to change it. What's going to change is getting access to huge swaths of our populations, which tend to be, underrepresented minorities or socioeconomically challenged or socioeconomically disadvantaged, who just don't have the type of access, trust in the system, access to the system, financial resources, skills, language, technology, access to navigate it the way the way others do. And I think unless we start taking that seriously and recognize that's where we need to focus in order to actually get the morbidity and mortality curves to start moving in the wrong direction, in some ways, what we've just talked about for the last 30 or 40 minutes is almost irrelevant. And I think it's important to bring us back there. We're doing a lot of work. I would put it in sort of two tranches. One tranche of work that we're doing at the ACC is to try to just open up the doors to cardiology, to invite in and welcome in underrepresented minorities in medicine and make sure that they know that they are welcomed and that we want them in cardiology. And creating pathways all the way down to middle school, through high school, through college, through medical school, through internship, where they can find members and welcoming and being actively invited. And we're actually seeing a lot of good progress on that, where particularly for African-Americans, Hispanics, and women are really taking advantage of that and kind of embracing the opportunity to come into cardiology. And we strongly believe that unless we have a more diverse provider community, we're going to have a hard time understanding the needs of the patient populations that we're treating. And one of the things I love about cardiology is it's so empirical, is that this isn't a social or political talking point. The evidence is just absolutely clear about the outcomes differentials for many of these populations that we need to improve on. So that's part of it, inviting people in, educating, and so forth. But we're also looking how we, for example, train the next generation of investigators who are willing to run clinical trials in not your traditional sites. So it's kind of well known in academic cardiology, there are kind of 200 sites in the country that tend to run vast majority of the trials.
Yep.
Shocker, many of the populations that have never made it into the trials, African Americans, Hispanic, Native, and Indigenous peoples, that's not where those sites are located. So, you know, we can't ask those people to come to the sites we've always done the trials. We need to actually take that research infrastructure to the hospitals and to the settings where they have access to it, they have trusting relations, there are providers that they trust, and are willing to have access to this, so that we can develop the evidence and understand how to treat them just as well as we do our majority populations. One of the things that I love that we're doing right now is we're as part of our sort of young investigator program of helping to educate early researchers who are interested in getting involved as principal investigators or site PIs and so forth, we run a course, a program that helps teach and mentor them. And we've been really reaching out and actually using the NCDR registries to understand, okay, where are our populations that we need to attract into clinical trials? Where are they actually seeking mm-hmm. care? Where are they have doctors that they trust? And then going and reaching out to those physicians and saying, hey, you might have never thought about being a PI, but you are clearly a great structural interventionalist. You're doing TAVR. You're seeking these patients. Would you ever think about getting involved in this so that we can bring access to this research to those populations? And that's really, really exciting to us. And then there's a lot of work that we're doing around the impacts of diversity and equity on actual outcomes. And so Melvin Eccles, our chief diversity officer, when I sat down and you know, with him when we first talked, and I remember this very clearly, and I sort of was lamenting the scale of the problem. How do we get around this? And he said to me, Brendan, he said, just think about it like a quality improvement project. He said, identify the gap, look at what's driving that gap, think about the resources or tools you could use the gap, and close a gap, and then move on to your next one. You know, and that's not going to solve all of society's ills, but it's given us a framework to start thinking about using the NCDR registries and so forth to see, okay, where do we have differential outcomes? Which sites need help with that? What type of resources would they need? So that we, instead of just kind of lamenting the problem, there's a lot of just observing the enormity of this problem, that we're actually starting to take concrete action steps towards fixing it. And that work has been really, really inspiring and gratifying to be a part of.
That's amazing. And I think it is going to require diverse efforts to achieve diversity and equity and inclusion, because if you look at, for instance, a population health database from a health record, like a healthcare system, you'll find that ethnicity and a lot of the demographics are poorly populated within these systems. And so you'll need sort of a grassroots campaign, I think, within those systems to help engage those clinicians, those patients, encourage more documentation of that within the chart so that we can start to use some of these larger analytics at a population level to identify gaps. I think one of the things that we do on the clint side is with trial recruitment is we try to bring that lens in to shine a light on all the eligible patients at once, not just a first come, first serve approach, where you can then say, well, let's oversample from this underrepresented group. But that only works if the documentation of that individual's, you know, social determinants of health are there, right? In terms of bringing those patients forward, whether it's elderly patients, female patients, underrepresented minorities, like these are things that I think are challenges that can be solved through a combination of efforts, but no single methodology may do it because of some of those documentation limitations or just the limitations of grassroots campaigns. But I think together it can be really powerful. So that's a very exciting approach that the college is taking.
And if you think about, you know, what I was saying maybe a few minutes ago where we felt kind of stuck by this RCT that drives guidelines, and then we're not getting the right therapies to patients, and we don't know how to think ourselves out of that box. Here's an area where actually, if you think about how the stakeholders have worked together, there are a lot of aligned forces that are starting to make some positive movement. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, once the FDA said, you know what, life sciences companies, you need to be recruiting minimum numbers of minority patients for your device trials and your pharmacy trials. All of a sudden, that takes a value that we all believe in, and it puts some teeth into it because you have some regulatory teeth. Now those life sciences come, and working with Clint and the work that we've been doing together, Raj, okay, now we have a reason to actually find those populations and to reach out to those populations. And so we're getting, you know, the social interest aligned with the government interest, which is aligned with the economic interest, and lo and behold, we're starting to make the investments in the technology and so forth that we can find these folks and recruit them. And as we've pointed out, you know, some of those patients actually really need that care. They tend to be a little sicker, so it actually enriches trials, may make them a little shorter, a little easier to run. So there might be some synergies and some advantages there. So in some ways, I think this is an example where things are actually moving in the right direction. It feels like we're making progress on. But one of the things I always like, I have to remind myself about, is that, you know, think about the way artificial intelligence is being talked about in the public right now, right? I mean, we have these sort of doomsday scenarios, this Terminator, this existential threat, which I personally think is overblown. I'm much more worried about you being used for discrimination for insurance rates or access to healthcare and stuff like this. But you have this in the zeitgeist. And then we're saying to populations that have been most abused by the established system, most disenfranchised, most taken advantage of, if we start showing up and say, oh yes, our artificial intelligence has picked you out as you would being a great candidate for this trial, I don't think that's going to go over real well. I think it's going to be a disaster, right? And so Melvin and I spend a lot of time, it's like, how do you, on one hand, we have to use all this technology. There's no other way to deal with the scale, and to not use it would be a dereliction mm-hmm. of duty. But if we're not putting every bit as much effort in building the networks, building a new generation of cardiologists that if you don't have necessarily racial concordance, you have enough diversity that when a patient walks into a hospital, they're like, okay, this place looks like a place that I feel comfortable in. If you're not spending that time with that each individual patient, you know, why they should think about being in a trial, making sure that there are cardiologists and clinical recruitment staff that understand culturally, linguistically, religiously, socially, the context of those folks. It doesn't matter what we do with this technology. It's just going to look like one more, you know, kind of oppressive thing. And maybe it is, right? So, you know, Melvin and I, when we talk about this, we're constantly talking about, all right, what's the right investment of technology? And how do you balance that with the humanism? Because if we lose the humanism in all of this, you know, I think we're in deep, deep trouble. And that's kind of the lesson that I always have to remind myself, because I can, you know, geek out on what the technology is going to do. And if I lose track of the human being on the other side, I'm doing everybody a disfavor.
No, I love it. No, I think you're absolutely right. We have some exciting days in front of us with the technology marrying with ethical guidance from within and within our organizations. And I'm really reassured and happy that you are in the position you're in at the college, which is, you know, for all of the cardiology community is a guiding light for us to sort of base our practices on. So it's wonderful to hear that this is top of mind for you as well. I think that's the time that we have today. It's been an amazing conversation. It's great to catch up. I really want to thank you for making time late on a Friday for you to spend with us, and looking forward to continuing working with you and the college on many of the things we talked about today. But thanks so much, Brendan.
Well, thanks, Raj. I had a lot of fun. And, you know, before I close, I'm very grateful to be in the position I am at the ACC. It's a wonderful organization. And, you know, all of this stuff that we've developed has come out of conversations with just exceptional cardiologists and exceptional member leaders like yourselves. And without the energy and the dedication of the volunteerism that they put in, the organization just wouldn't be what it is. So it's great to be able to share some of the things we're doing, but I think credit goes to you as cardiologists and to our whole community for making these issues priorities and always having the guts to push forward.
Thanks, Brendan. We're looking forward to continuing doing that. All right. Have a great weekend. We'll talk to you later. Thanks.